This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Always some interesting news and research to talk about, Zorba. What have you for us this time?
Marriage beats money for happiness.
What do you want?
Can't buy
love
me.
Or money?
love or money.
I guess love.
What we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some very interesting poll surveys. Looking at money, looking at marriage, where does it fit in? And we're going to talk about fast food in hospitals.
Yeah.
In hospitals like children's hospitals. Are they good for our kids?
A lot of children's hospitals have fast food in there.
We're going to talk about that fast food, and we're going to talk about hospital food in general, and is it good for us?
Okay, that coming up. And speaking of food, our recipe?
Yes, Dijon chicken dinner. This is a wonderful dish. It's wonderful for anyone who likes that sort of taste of mustard and the taste of sweet that's in there. It's been a standard in our house for more than 25 years.
The sort of thing you'll find in any hospital.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We have our medical myth buster coming up, too. So don't go away. Again, if you want to talk with Zorba, give us a call. Always happy to hear from you. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Verona, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba.
Hi. How are
really
you?
Really enjoy your show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
My question is about secondhand smoke, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation where we have grandparents of our 1.5-year-old who smoke in their house. And, of course, they're wonderful, wonderful grandparents to their granddaughter. However, now that she's a little bit older, they really want to spend some more time with her and have overnight visits and such. And I just wonder if you could address what are the challenges of secondhand smoke, with smaller children. They obviously don't smoke when she's visiting. However, they smoke in their house when she's not there, and so that smoke is still in the house, and you can smell it when you walk in. And I was just wondering if you could address that situation or if there's any research out there to support a good idea or a bad idea.
Oh, sure. Well, obviously you're not going to divorce the grandparents from your child.
No, not at all. They're wonderful grandparents. You know, I just would like to say that, but, very set in their ways, and
right,
I really don't think
not,
they'll be quitting.
You bet. They're not. They're probably not going to quit for your grandchild. When you go into the house, you smell all of the particles, the particulate matter of the smoke on their clothes and everything else. There really is not a lot of evidence that causes disease. It's really the smoke. It's the particles when they're in the air that really do it. So I think the risk of any significant secondhand smoke is not an issue. It's secondhand stink more than secondhand smoke.
Certainly an irritant, but maybe not a health problem for the grandchild.
I don't think it's a health problem. I've never seen any research that looks at that. But, it really is a talking moment for the grandparents. And it really is saying, hey, you smoke, and there's data that shows if a parent smokes, a child is more likely to smoke. I've never seen any data that shows if a grandparent smokes, you're more likely to smoke. But certainly if a parent smokes, you're more likely to smoke. And so I think it's always a good time to say, hey, I know you're set in your ways, but the reality is, smoking really isn't very good. It stinks. Granddaughter's coming over here. When was the last time you tried to quit smoking? Bring that up to them.
Yeah.
And the reason is they may not have tried for a number of years. This gives them a chance to try again. It takes the average smoker four to six times.
We may not have a health problem for the grandchild here, but there certainly is a health problem for the grandparents.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the grandchild may motivate them to quit smoking. Don't give up the ship and say that they can't, because people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s actually do give up smoking when they're motivated, and so I think it's a good talking moment too.
Well, good. I hope they do. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, speaking of grandparents, let's take a question from Grandma Sue in Madison, who writes, I'm a first-time grandma and maybe a little overprotective, but I'm concerned about my granddaughter. The other grandfather seems to think it's fun to throw his other little grandsons in the air. It looks like a human bungee jump. He grabs the little guy by his ankles and lets him jump and swing away. Everyone loves it, but I'm concerned that it might create too much pressure on his little brain. Should I let him do this to my granddaughter?
You know, this brings up some really sort of problematic issues. There is something called shaken baby syndrome, and these are where babies are shaken too much. But for the most part, the data on shaken baby syndrome are people who shake their babies to get them to stop crying. I mean, in other words, it's people who abnormally shake the child when their child is crying and say, stop crying,
but
stop
holding
crying.
Holding by the ankles and swinging around, that sounds a little
It really kind
extreme.
Of depends on the amount of torque and the amount of force that's being used. It certainly is fine to take a little baby and throw a baby up in the air and catch your baby if the baby is safe.
That's fun to do
that's
for just about everybody.
That's fun to do, and it's fun, and it really is okay. But, I mean, if you're taking your baby by the ankles and you're swinging around like a lasso, you can just picture at the other extreme. That really isn't good for the baby. And so without looking and seeing how this baby is shaken or this baby is played with or the grandchild, it's really hard for me to make a judgment. And as a grandparent, they're doing it out of love. This is not the same thing as shaken baby syndrome.
Of course.
My recommendation is if you're actually taking it by your feet, you actually have to exert more torque in order to be able to get a baby to stand up. And so that really may be the issue. And doing it in a more gentle way may be the issue. Now, once again, these are parental issues and they're cultural issues. So the other issue is, you know, obviously we love to throw up babies and catch them. It's so much fun and they like it. We also go on to roller coasters and babies also, you know, get swung. Yeah. But moderation is the key. Use good judgment. That's
this is a little tough because we have the two sets of grandparents, and this is the one part of one set of grandparents being critical of the one of the the other grandparent. Right. There's a little touchy family issue.
Yeah, the other issue is to discuss it with their family physician, either the family physician who's taking care of the baby or the pediatrician who's taking care of the baby, and just get them involved and say, how much do you think I should do it? And you know, sometimes we get things involved medically, we can bring it up because you can easily change your behavior. You can easily say, I want to throw this baby up in the air, which is great, but I don't want to hurt this baby.
Yeah.
But it's touchy, like you said. It's touchy.
We always like hearing from you. Just make sure your grandpa lets you down first. Just send us your comments, tips, and questions to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, our toll-free number, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
This is another concerned grandmother.
Oh.
My husband and I have four grandchildren here in St. Louis, ages 14, 13, 9, and 3. And I'm concerned because their parents have insisted on a pretty much a dairy-free diet for them. Mom and Dad think that dairy contributes to respiratory illnesses, and so they have pretty much eliminated dairy from these kids' diet. And I see them mostly drinking water, which is better than soda, I guess. But I'm worried about them getting enough calcium to support their bones throughout their lives.
This comes up every now and then, Zorba.
Right. So they're worried that it actually causes respiratory disease.
That's what they think.
And there's no scientific proof for that at all. It's sort of, it really stems back to a guy named Osawa who did the macrobiotic diet. This was a diet that's now been discredited because it produces scurvy. It's so specific and so anti, for instance, vitamin C, that it actually produced scurvy in young children in California, and that diet is hardly followed at all. There are a lot of people who believe that when they have a cold, that if they drink dairy products that they produce more mucus. Now, that may be the case, but that's different than preventing a respiratory infection.
Well, what about the possible dangers of a milk-free
diet? The dangers, you know, you can get calcium from other areas. There are a number of cultures where after the child is weaned, there's not much milk that's actually used in the society. And that has to do with how we digest milk. There are a lot of Asian societies where milk is not as common as is in European societies. And you can get calcium from other things besides milk. Do they give them any cheese at all, or yogurt, or totally dairy? It's totally dairy-free?
I think they have some cheese. I don't think the kids like yogurt.
Well, first of all, staying away from high fructose corn syrup drinks, of course, is important because high fructose is garbage. You know, it's really, they're empty calories, and we have too much of it in our society. It causes obesity, and I now believe that it is addictive, that that basically the more you drink, the more you want of it.
So
you want to avoid that. You know, you're not gonna do much with this family. That's for sure. You know, they're, you know, you can go back and give them information, but I think the information is, hey, if they have a respiratory disease, if they're sick with an upper respiratory infection, there are a number of people who believe that staying away from dairy will actually produce less mucus. But the reality is, there's no evidence at all that dairy products cause upper respiratory infections in any way, and they may want to go out of that. But there are a number of vegans, and they raise children, and vegans do not have any dairy at all. They raise children, and they're just like other children and all, and you can get calcium from other sources.
Okay.
So, you know, and it doesn't have to be from a calcium tablet either. But it's more difficult because the calcium in dairy products is so concentrated and easy to get. Remember, though, they don't have control over what those teenagers are eating. They may have control at home, but they don't have control outside of the house any more than any other parent.
Right. But for, like, the little three-year-old, you know,
absolutely. So how tall are the older kids? They tall?
No.
Are the parents tall?
No.
Well, then this doesn't necessarily mean anything if they're about the same size as the parents. For the most part, humans have a way of just adjusting to these changes. They are not going to have brittle bones.
Oh, good.
They're not going to have brittle bones. A lot of kids stop eating, especially girls, stop eating dairy products during their high-growth preteen years. That's a big issue because they're more at risk, we think, for osteoporosis when they get older. But that's more of an issue of weight and society than it is parents and what foods they'll let their kids eat. I think I'd go to the web and bring down some material and talk to them. You have a good relationship with them
about? Yes, I do.
Well, I think I'd say, hey, when they have they have a cold, no dairy, but there's no evidence. You cannot say that dairy causes colds. And it doesn't. You know, they're viruses. So.
Well, I'll suggest that to them.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. 800-462-7413. So, Zorba, they did a poll, and it turns out that married people are happier than rich people.
Can't buy me love, right? Can't buy me love. The Beatles said that a long time ago. Well, these are a number of polls. This is basically a Gallup poll. These are polls that are done on a regular basis that look at marriage and satisfaction in America. And, you know, some of these are more scientific than others. But Gallup is really pretty good. And they looked at 1,000 adults. And what they did is they compared married to single. Okay, married to single. Okay, so if we look at married, just simply married versus single, 64% of married people said that they were very satisfied with the way their personal life was going. So 2 out of 3 said they were very satisfied. Remember, this is a 1 to 5 scale. So satisfied, also a lot of people, but very satisfied is sort of the top.
Okay.
Only 43% of the singles were very satisfied. So what does this mean? Well, it may mean that married people are more satisfied, or that people who are more satisfied become married. You know, there's a chicken and egg thing. But when we look at incomes, we find some very interesting things. 72% of the people, so a little bit more, with incomes of $75,000 or more said they were very satisfied. Only 36% of those with income of $30,000 or less were. So in other words, only 1 out of 3 who are not making very much by today's standards.
And rich people are more satisfied than married people.
Twice as many rich people are satisfied than married people. However, the highest amount were people who were rich and married, and they were the most satisfied. And rich, they define in this, were incomes of $75,000 a year. But one of the real issues that's come up in all of these studies have really shown that once you become sort of solidly middle class, you've got some time off for vacation, you've got a little bit of money to be able to go on a vacation. It may not be the vacation you want to Hawaii at a 5-star hotel, but it can be a vacation somewhere where you can have some time off and enjoy a good meal. Once you get to that part, you really are at another level of life satisfaction. And then finding someone else to satisfy that seems to be just a natural human thing, that most people want to have friends and family. It may not be a marriage, but it may be friends and family. But marriage may be a marker for personal satisfaction, and that's kind of an issue. We know, for instance, single life is a marker for other problems. More people with alcoholism and drug abuse and other problems are single than married. So, you know, this is very hard to make a decision.
As you pointed out, it may be very difficult for a really miserable person to hook up. So it may be difficult.
That's exactly the fact that the person is single making
that person, a person may be very unhappy in the first place,
but just not able to come up with a partner. When I wrote my book on longevity, the Longevity Code, one of the things, and as I was doing my research, was that social satisfaction, social relationships were as important as cholesterol, were as important as blood pressure in terms of simple longevity, how long you're going to live. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the life satisfaction point of view, it's really the same thing, that the social relationships that you have in your life are extremely important. And sometimes we kind of ignore these. We don't nurture these as much as we should. Certainly in a doctor's office, a doctor never says, well, how's your marriage, how are your social relationships? It's pretty rare that physicians say that. They say, how's your cholesterol, what's your blood pressure, you know, what are your lab tests, thank you very much, next.
Yeah, and there are people who have a lot of money who think they don't have quite enough money. Sometimes some of us always want more, and so we're not happy with what we have.
The data also shows that once you get above a certain number, which is, you know, probably $100,000, $125,000 a year, at that point, actually, things level off. And the difference in life satisfaction in other surveys, between, for instance, between $100,000 and $1 million a year is minimal. Absolutely minimal. And it's very, very interesting. I'll tell you a story. I was out skiing. I met a wonderful person at the top of a ski hill. I happen to know, will not mention their name. Very, very nice. Known them for a number of years. A person had recently had a marriage, and she's got, there's a blended family. And I was looking at this rock that she had in her hand, which was like a 4 or 5 carat diamond or something, like something big. And I said, how are life going? And they had just moved to California. And she said, well, we like it out in California. We'd rather be back in Wisconsin, but we really like California a lot. And I wish I had all my children out here this weekend. And I said, why can't you? And she said, well, only 8 people fit in the jet. So it's very interesting. Only 8 people fit in the private jet, and they have a blended family.
So every year, they
have to decide who gets to go to the house and who doesn't. And they only have so many bedrooms in the house. And I thought to myself, that's very interesting. They're limited. She has a 5-carat diamond. She lives in Santa Barbara. She's limited by the size of the jet and the number of bedrooms in the house. So money doesn't always buy happiness.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And a listener with us now, Zorba in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I have an inquiry about wax buildup in my ear. For about the last year, when I lay on my right side, sometimes when I turn over from my right side, my ear will almost kind of be clogged, muffled, almost to where I can't hear out of it. And then if I rub it, you know, it opens back up and I'm fine.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if there's a home remedy for that, or
have you ever had your ears irrigated on? Has anyone looked in your ears
for checkups? Uh-huh. Yeah, and they've always said they were fine.
Last checkup,
probably a year and a half ago. And this has been going on for almost a year.
Well, one of the things that's really important is, especially if your ears are clogged, is it could be wax. Now, you can't tell without going into an office and looking to see whether or not they're waxing ears. But if you don't have a fever and you don't have any evidence of a discharge that might be an infection at all, you can go and easily get an ear wax removal kit. They have them at every drugstore. Right. They come under the name brand of Murine, and they come out under a number of generics. They've got a little bulb syringe in there that doesn't produce too much pressure, and they've got direction. And basically, you put in this penetrating oil. It's not really penetrating oil like a rock, rather like a lock, but it really is penetrating oil that gets in the wax and helps dislodge the wax. And then you irrigate out your ears and see if things are better. And especially, rather than paying for a doctor's visit, paying for a doctor's call, I'd recommend, you're a young guy, why don't you go there, get an earwax removal kit, see if it works. And if you, you get a chunk of wax out and you hear better, there's your answer.
Yeah.
And if not, then it isn't. Another thing you can also do is you can go and get otoscopes, are called, which are things to look inside the ear. You can actually buy them now. Parents buy them, and they cost like $30 or $40.
A little hard to use on yourself.
You can't. Just, you can't look in your own ear. That would be really tough. You'd have to use a mirror system to be able to do that. God, Tom, there's always one. You are on top of your game today.
Yeah, I have wax in the ear
really?
Situation.
Maybe
yeah,
that's why you can't hear never can't hear me whenever I say anything. That
what?
Must be it.
But I see a hearing or an ear guy on a regular basis, and he gave me some good advice, I think, just the last time I was there. He said he knows an ear doctor who keeps one of those syringes in the shower.
Yeah, in the shower.
And every time he showers, he spritzes out his...
So this is the ear doctor who spritzes
out his... Yeah, he has a wax buildup and a hearing problem.
Yeah, it sounds like he's got obsessive compulsive disease, too. I mean, the ear got the inside out of your ears every time you're in the shower?
And it's not a bad thing, especially for a person who happens to have a hearing problem and wear hearing aids to keep the wax from, getting involved in the hearing aid.
You mean every single day you get out the ears inside the shower?
As often as you shower, it keeps the wax from building up, and it takes 2 seconds. That's not obsessive.
It's a little bit obsessive. What are you talking about?
Cleanliness.
Every single time you're in the shower, you go and you plug up, you take this ear syringe and you irrigate out your ears. I call that obsessive.
You don't think
it's obsessive?
My ears are cleaner than your ears.
They're pristine.
Hey, we have a good recipe coming up. Dijon chicken dinner.
It is great.
This is one that you use often, do you not?
I love it. 25 years.
So stay tuned for that. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. And we have a medical myth buster as well. So do stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Boy, that's good. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health Recipe Time. Before we get back to your calls, during that short break, I've been sampling the goodie that Adam Friedrich cooked up, your recipe, Zorba, for Dijon chicken dinner. You haven't had a chance, but you have this all the time.
I have this all. We have had variations of this recipe. It is wonderful. For more than 25 years in our house, we've used various variations of this recipe.
I'd put another bite in my mouth, but I wouldn't be able to do my most important job of the show, which is saying the ingredients after Zorba says them.
That's right. If you have another thing, you're just going to drool all over it.
Okay, let's do Dijon chicken dinner.
It is great. It is simple. It is easy. It is a fun dish to do, and there are lots of variations that you can imagine on this. I like it because it's cheap. It's inexpensive, and my kids like it.
I like it because it's cheap.
Cheap is okay.
Why am I not surprised?
Why are you not? Why am I known that much for my frugalness? I didn't say it's frugal.
Well, let's get through this so I can finish up my meal.
One tablespoonful of extra virgin olive oil.
One big tea. Extra virgin olive oil.
Use the best. Always use extra virgin olive oil. You will not be disappointed. It is worth the money. One quarter of a cup of seasoned flour, and I'll explain what that is.
Quarter of a cup of seasoned
flour. Now, you can buy seasoned flour prepackaged in the grocery store. Basically, seasoned flour has flour in it with some salt and pepper, maybe some garlic powder, some garlic salt, a little paprika that's in there. If you go to the web and you write down seasoned flour, you can find a whole bunch of recipes for seasoned flour if you don't want to, spend the money. They're not that expensive to buy a pre-seasoned flour. I often use Chef Louis, who had a famous store called The Bakery in Chicago, and he made a seasoned flour, and that's the one that I tend to use all the time. It's easy, and I make it up and put it in a little ball jar and keep it in the house. You could also use seasoned breadcrumbs, by the way, for this. That's another variation. Three chicken breasts.
Three chicken breasts.
That's right. You can use boneless, skinless chicken breasts if you want to. You can use regular chicken breasts. Of course, they will taste better because they have the skin. The skin is going to have more fat, but it's going to have more flavor to it. Mm-hmm. You can use chicken thighs if you want to. Thigh meat has more fat, but it also is more flavorful. And often we will eat less food when it has a higher fat content for something such as chicken. Many people eat less food. But any one of those will work for either chicken breasts or the boneless, skinless.
You're stretching this out, aren't you?
Yeah.
Not going to let me. Get to the
it's not
food.
A lot of ingredients here.
Okay.
Four garlic cloves finely chopped. 1 cup unsalted chicken broth.
Cup of unsalted chicken broth.
Right. If you can have low sodium, it's a little better. Regular chicken broth is fine, too. Half an onion finely chopped.
Half an onion. finely chopped.
That's right. Quarter of a cup of Dijon mustard. I use name brand Dijon mustard because that makes the biggest difference. Using a prepared mustard that you like the flavor of. You can use any mustard as you want, that you want to. Not the bright yellow mustard. It won't work well. But a Dijon mustard, I buy them in the big jars because if I buy a small jar, it's about, I use almost the whole jar and it's more expensive.
So a quarter cup of Dijon mustard.
I'm always looking to save money on recipes. A tablespoonful of honey.
Big tea of honey.
If you like it, you can double that or triple that. I use a tablespoonful of honey. And a teaspoon of dry thyme.
Little tea, dried thyme.
Okay, so in a large skillet.
May I eat while you're talking?
Of course, please. Don't let me stop you. You ate before I started talking. You before in the middle, you just can't keep your you love this stuff. In a large skillet, heat the oil, then lightly coat the chicken breast in seasoned flour. Quickly brown the chicken on both sides. Okay? Remove the chicken from the skillet and reduce the heat. Then add the garlic to the skillet and sauté for about 2 minutes. Not too hot. You don't want it to burn. You want it to sauté really without browning too much. Then add chicken broth, onion, Dijon mustard, and thyme to the skillet. Whisk it up. You can either use a spoon or a slotted spoon or whisk it up. And then bring to a simmer over medium heat and then add the chicken back to the pot. And what you're really doing now is you're poaching the chicken until it's cooked through. And that takes about 20 minutes. You want to make sure the chicken is cooked through so there's no pink in the middle and the chicken breast is at 165 degrees. And if you're concerned, use a microwave instant thermometer for that. Then transfer the chicken to the plate. Increase the heat until the liquid boils. And then you can reduce that to a sauce consistency if you want to. In other words, let a little bit of the water boil out. That takes a minute or two. Pour it over the chicken and serve it. And bon appetit and give me that plate.
Well, you have it all the time.
Give me that plate.
I think I'll just finish.
I want that plate. I can't stand it. It's all the way
over there. You can't get it from on the other side of the table.
Please give me the plate. Please give me the plate. I did say please. And this is,
this
is good. With these potatoes inside.
Adam, you did a nice job on those potatoes, too.
Adam did a great job. Adam has become a fine chef.
Next time, a little veggie on the side. Good.
It's about 400 calories, 8 grams of fat, so it's not high fat, a little saturated fat, but not very much at all, and not much in the way of sodium because we cut that off with low-sodium chicken broth, and it's wonderful. A lot of protein, 57 grams of protein. That's more than you need for your entire day. In other words, it's a high-protein, very moderate-calorie meal. I highly recommend
good.
It. It's great. Kids will love it. It's wonderful.
It sure tastes good. Here's our Dijon chicken dinner recipe for you. If you'd like it, just address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip code 53706. Be sure to enclose a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We'll be happy to send the recipe along to you.
Or you can get it on our website at zorbapastor.org. You'll get that recipe, see some fun pictures, and get other recipes on there that I think you will like too.
Is our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. A listener joins us now, Zorba, in Snoqualmie, Washington. Did I say that right?
It's pretty close, Snoqualmie. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
Hi. What's up?
So I want to know if I should really make my husband drink his milk left in the cereal bowl in the morning. I have a theory that all those vitamins and nutrients they say that are in the cereal are just sprayed on at the end. And so if he's not drinking the milk, he's missing out on those vitamins and nutrients.
Oh, interesting. You think the milk washes away the nutrients away?
Yeah, I feel like maybe I read it somewhere or just maybe I think it. But I have to know whether or not it's worth fighting a battle with my husband.
Worth fighting a battle with your husband over the milk left in the bowl. That's right.
Battle.
That's right. Well, Judge, that was the cause for our divorce, you know. He wouldn't drink the milk at the bottom of the bowl, and I wanted him to drink it, and that's it. We're just no longer compatible. You know, I don't know when the vitamins are put in. You bring up a really neat point. Are they sprayed on somewhere in the process so the vitamins are superficial, or are the vitamins placed within the grain when the grain is actually baked? And I have no idea at all. I mean, we're talking none. I am sure that someone out there is going to send us some information on this. I'm sure that we'll find out.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Why doesn't your husband want to finish up the milk? Because it always tastes kind of good after it's been...
Well, I think so. I always screw up drinking the milk, but he just, when he's done, he just pours it down the drain.
Oh, pours it down the drain. Children are starving in Europe. That's a waste. My mother would have never done that. I wasn't able to leave the table until I finished every single drop of milk in the bottom of the bowl, whether or not I liked it or not. It's often sweeter also because you tend to put sugar on that cereal, you know, so I happen to love the milk at the bottom of the bowl. Well, the easy rectification for this is take a vitamin tablet every day and then you don't have to think about it at all. What's the cereal that he eats?
Oh, we have so many different cereals in the house.
You know something? I don't think this is worth a fight over. I don't think so. I think you pick and choose your fights, and milk at the bottom of the cereal, I'd kind of put at the bottom of the list if there were like the 100 things that you don't fight about. I would put down, don't fight about the milk at the bottom of the cereal bowl after you finish it. But I'm sure someone will let us know about the vitamins. Once again, if you have cereal that's vitamin fortified, it's a good way to do it. I recommend a vitamin tablet to everyone because I think it's a good simple way of getting vitamins. Mm-hmm. Multivitamin with minerals, and if it says USP, it meets certain guidelines. It's cheap, it's easy, it's $10 to $20 a year, and you've got all the vitamins.
Our producer Adam Friedrich recommends serving him cocoa puffs, and then the milk will be chocolate milk.
There he goes.
He'll actually finish.
And
that.
Adam is only talking from experience. When
he is.
That.
Absolutely.
And probably cereal number two that he would recommend would be Captain Crunch. That's it, Cap'n Crunch. Sorry, Cap'n Crunch. I pronounced the Cap'n
anyway,
wrong.
Sorry we couldn't help you with the answer to that.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Wait a minute. We did help her with the answer to that.
Yes,
we said don't at multivitamin
and don't fight.
Don't fight about it.
Absolutely.
But we still don't know
if the vitamins are sprayed, but that was a secondary. The question was, should she fight over it?
You're
the answer is
you're
no.
Right. And you did answer that question.
We're very specific with that.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. To Pocatello, Idaho, we go now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about eating walnuts and canker sores. The story begins when I was in my childhood years. I loved walnuts, and so I'd eat a ton of them, and I'd find that I'd get a canker sore or two a couple days after. Now it's progressed to where if I eat just even a quarter of a walnut, immediately the next day I have a canker sore. So I was wondering, is there anything I can do to prevent getting the canker sores? And also, is there anything that I can do to treat the canker sores so they go away faster?
Avoid walnuts.
Yeah, don't eat walnuts.
That's what it is. Avoid walnuts, you know?
I can't do that. I love them.
I mean, you know, walnuts are not one of the four basic food groups, you know? I mean, walnuts just don't fit in there. You know,
well, he wants to eat walnuts and not get canker sores.
You want to eat walnuts and not get... Well, there must be something in the walnut that may be doing it. That's it. I've got a couple questions for you. So is it every time you eat the walnut or just some of the times you eat the walnuts?
It's every time.
Mm-hmm. Every single time. You know what I mean? You know, every nut is a little different and has a little different oil in it. And there must be something that you are obviously sensitive to.
Why did you look at me when you said every nut is a little different?
Every nut is a little different. Because you're on the other side of the table,
Tom.
That's the reason I looked at you. It had nothing to do with what I was saying.
All right, I won't take it personally.
But there must be something in the walnut, probably in the oil, that's actually doing it. You know, treatment for canker sores, usually it's a topical treatment that you get. There are a bunch of over-the-counter remedies, and one is probably pretty much as good as another. I do have a recommendation, though. Do you like yogurt?
Yeah.
I'd have yogurt before you have the canker sores. Before you have the walnuts, before you have the canker sores, you looked at me in a funny way. Before you eat the walnuts, have some yogurt.
But I think I'll have some yogurt first.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Anyway,
The reason is that when you get yogurt, especially Danon yogurt or another yogurt that says live culture, it has to say live culture. You're going to fill your mouth with lactobacillus, and if you have lactobacillus prior to having the walnut, you may actually have put the bacteria. These are live bacteria that we live with bacteria, and they may actually protect you from that. So that would be a recommendation. Another way would be to get their lactobacillus tablets and capsules that you can have, but that's a little medicinal. You know, it's a little, you know, and I would go with the live culture. See if that works and let us know, because that would be really a natural sort of almost homeopathic remedy that would help you, because you're putting the lactobacillus in the mouth, therefore protecting the mouth, and then having the walnuts. And if that allows you, well, then you have your favorite yogurt before you eat your walnuts. The other issue is look at the amount of walnuts you're eating. You know, a smaller amount may not do it. A larger amount may do it. So sometimes it's the quantity of walnuts that you actually have. So you really love walnuts, huh?
Walnuts are my favorite. But
walnuts are your favorite.
Them.
So yogurt before walnuts.
Sounds good.
Sounds like it's going to become a slogan now. Yogurt before walnuts, you know. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yep, appreciate the call. Thanks for calling 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's grab a quick question from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now. This one comes to us from Diana in Decorah, Iowa. She writes, I've been hearing recently that unrefined sea salt is better for you than regular table salt. I wonder where on earth she'd be hearing about sea salt and kosher salt so much.
Oh, yeah,
could be a
right.
doctor show on the radio,
that's
maybe.
Exactly, that's exactly
they,
it.
They say it has over 80 minerals and that table salt only has two or three. Is kosher and sea salt any different nutrition-wise from table salt?
Well, kosher salt, first of all, if you look at regular salt that you have on the table that right. flows, there is an aluminum compound that's put in there, I think it's aluminum silicate, that allows it to flow and keeps it from taking on moisture. And that's what we use, and it was invented by Morton 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and that's the salt that's most commonly used in table salt. And then iodine is added to it, which is an essential nutrient.
Right.
And the adding of iodine to salt changed the course of goiter and thyroid disease in the middle of the country where people did not eat fish, and that's really important. Iodine is an essential nutrient, so I recommend iodized salt to anyone on a regular basis.
What about this 80 minerals from?
Well, it turns out sea salt has some minerals in it. But these are microscopic, really, really tiny amounts, and the amounts are they're infinitesimal amounts. So a lot of people claim sea salt is better for you because it has infinitesimal amounts. It does not have iodine in it, by the way, in any appreciable amount. Mm-hmm. But I think when you're talking about salting the food on the top of food, not cooking with food, that a kosher salt or sea salt that you grind has a better taste to it. There's evidence of that. But on the whole, you don't want to stop iodized salt in your diet because you need the iodine.
Gotcha.
You need the iodine. If not, you've got to take a vitamin pill and make sure that there's iodine.
And as far as nutritional value, I'm hearing you say
it's minimal.
Negligible.
I think it's more of a taste issue.
Yeah.
I think it's a taste issue and not a nutritional issue. If you want those micronutrients, you can easily get them from a tablet to have them, or you can just alternate. Once again, a little regular table salt with iodine in it during some part of the day and a little bit of sea salt or kosher salt during other times of the day. But you don't want to ignore getting the iodine. That's a big issue, especially with children in the house. That's really crucial. Mm-hmm. But for all of us, iodine is crucial.
Yeah. One thing that's guaranteed to be great for your nutrition is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. So keep those emails coming. Just send them to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Coming up, our medical myth buster. Some more research and more of your calls, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phone, Zorba, disconcerting information, at least to some of us, it says here at least 59 of the nation's 250 children's hospitals have fast food restaurants.
Right, in the hospital system.
In the hospital.
This has been a growing movement. Just like libraries have food courts now, or they really have sort of coffee courts, hospitals have developed food courts for people.
Well, yeah, but the library isn't designed to make people healthier, and supposedly the hospital isn't.
Right. Now, it's interesting. When we look at hospital food overall, how healthy do you think hospital food is?
Compared to fast food, maybe it isn't much different.
Right, that's exactly it. And certainly compared to food, how many people go to hospitals to eat? Oh, I think I'm going to go to the hospital because they have some good food and that's delicious.
Yeah, I know.
The answer, of course, is not at all.
Right.
Not at all, other than in Nova Scotia, Canada, where I completed some of my training, where people actually came to the hospital because the food was awesome.
They had really good food.
You bet. It's a very, very rare event.
Of course, that's a million years ago. Who knows what it is?
It's a million years ago. That's right. A million years old. But if we look at this, you know, it is a little disconcerting. 60 of the 250 hospitals, you know, have fast food. And then this was a study that was done that found that if there's fast food in the hospital, the kids eat fast food often the day they're in the hospital. Well, there's no great shakes there, of course, versus kids who come from outside the hospital. But I think the issue is overall, how do we treat our children and how do we treat them when they're sick and when they're ill? I think it's important when you're in a hospital, it's not just the food that you eat, but it's the environment that you're eating in. And quite often, if we look at traditional cafeterias in the hospital, they're often put down in the basement, and they're just a place to sort of get some food, and they're often depressing.
A gloomy setting.
No, I mean, you think of it, they tend to be gloomy places.
Yeah.
And here it is, you're there with your child in a children's hospital, and they're sick.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Comfort. And where does comfort from? So this is not just a profit center for the hospital. It's comfort that people want. And I think if we look at fast food, we can't just look at fast food in the hospital. We have to look at fast food overall. 5% of the people eat at McDonald's. 3 to 5% eat at McDonald's practically every day in our society. That's the issue, more than the issue of whether or not it's really in the hospital. On the other hand, if hospitals began to improve the food that they served, of course, then it would be a better environment
for our children. How hard would that be?
It must be hard. We don't tend to see it. And more hospitals at the Cleveland Clinic, they tried to get the McDonald's out of the food court at the Cleveland Clinic. It never got out. The administrators said no. People want it. But they ended up getting more food in there healthier, you know, with healthier choices. So I think the answer is not to remove fast food from the hospitals, but to leave it there if it's there, but to introduce healthy food that children and adults will want to eat. This is really an overall society issue, and we've got to teach our kids to eat right.
Let's see if we can help some more callers. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Here's a listener, Zorba, in Hayden, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I've got a girlfriend, and she's doing this cleanse called the Master Cleanse. It involves maple syrup in a like a lemonade with a pinch of cayenne pepper, mm-hmm. and that's pretty much all you have other than kind of like a cleansing tea in the morning and at night for about 10 days. And I'm okay with her doing the diet, but I'm a little worried about the protein intake.
Are you saying that's all she eats for that 10 days?
Yep, pretty much.
What is she trying to accomplish with this?
It's supposed to be kind of a colon cleanse.
So that's a long time. I mean, I think that's an abnormal. 10 days is a long time to be not eating very much. I mean, basically what you're going to do is lose weight because you're not having anything to eat if you can follow it for all that time. Your body is also going to lose protein. And what's going to happen is you're going to destroy your protein over that 10-day period because you're fasting. That is a long fast to be without protein. And I don't think that's that healthy. Let's talk a little bit about the colon. You know, the colon is one of my favorite topics. I love the colon. When I think about the colon. But we have bacteria that live in our bodies and are an important part of our bodies. We don't want to get rid of them. They're important. They make vitamin K, for instance. Those are bacteria that we have. They make vitamin K. And we have bacteria that we live with from birth. You know, we're not sterile. Once we come out of our mom's womb, especially if we come out vaginally, we have bacteria. They like us. We like them. We live together. And this idea that we have to cleanse our colon is really overplayed. Very common in the U.S., the concept of, quote, cleansing your colon. But fasting, on the other hand, is a very ancient way to sort of restart your body, reorient your body. And if we look at food in our society, we eat too much food, too often, too much during the day. And the idea of fasting for a day or two, I think, is not a bad idea, mm-hmm. because we start thinking about what food means to us, and I think we then will tend to make better choices. But that's a day or two. I think 10 days is a long time. I'm not against fasting at all. I think it's useful mm-hmm. for one or two or 3 days. But I think once you get beyond 3 days, you run an issue with protein, calorie, malnutrition, breaking down a protein in the body. And I think protein is important. So that's a tough cleanse, and I don't think there's no scientific evidence that a cleanse that long is going to do any good to you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Appreciate
my
the call.
Pleasure.
Thanks. 800-462-7413.
You know, fasting is part of lots of different traditions, homeopathic traditions, for instance, Ayurvedic traditions, but these tend to be short fasts, and I think they're good. I think they can be an important part of your health process, but 10 days, too long.
Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. And today's myth has heated up debates on our show before, so let's put it to rest once and for all. Do microwaves destroy the nutrients in food?
And the answer is, for the most part, no.
But we want to talk about
what does destroy the nutrients. And it turns out the things that destroy nutrients, and for the most part these are vitamins, are how long the food is cooked, how much liquid is there, because that liquid essentially takes and transmits heat to the food, and what the temperature is. So the higher the temperature, the longer it's cooked, and the more liquid is in there, the more vitamins are out. So for instance, if you look at beans, if you take beans and you boil them in water, mm-hmm. you will lose more vitamins than you will if you take beans and put them in the microwave and just heat them up
mm-hmm.
because you're boiling them, and it's the boiling of them that does it. And this is especially important for fat-soluble vitamins such as folic acid, vitamin C, and vitamin B, for instance, all the B vitamins. So I think it's really, once again, it's the amount of cooking. It's not the method. So it's not the microwave. It's the amount of cooking and the amount of water. So if you take it and you put it on for 10 minutes, so you boil, you know, your beans in the microwave, you're going to lose the nutrients. But if you just warm the beans up, which is what you're doing, you don't.
Yeah, you
wouldn't. And it turns out to be a very efficient way.
It sounds like maybe microwaving would be better as far as the
nutrients are concerned. And that actually is the case. It's much better than boiling. But steaming is also a very efficient way of not removing nutrients. Lights, for instance, walking up with high heat over a short period of time, very efficient, keeps the nutrients. Steaming, very efficient because it keeps the nutrients because you keep it nice and crisp. And one other very important issue with microwaving that I think that's important is that when we look at the overall food that we're eating, if we keep it crisp and we keep it fresh, it makes a difference. But if the food we buy makes a difference. There were studies that were done that showed that frozen food, in some cases, has more vitamin. Frozen veggies mm-hmm. will have more vitamin than fresh vegetables that are in the store for 4 days. Because when they stay in the store, they also lose their vitamins.
Sure, I understand that. So microwaving is okay.
Microwaving is okay as long as it's short.
In fact, put the beans in there and enjoy the sparking show.
Yeah.
As we found out a few years ago
on
Zorba Pastor and Your Health.
Yes, we did.
We promise that emailing your myths you'd like Zorba to bust won't destroy any of their nutrients. Just send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, and Zorba, our next caller, is in San Antonio, Texas. Hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Fine, what's up?
I've been trying to figure out a proper diet. I'm a truck driver, and I travel maybe 25 to 28 days out of a month. I'm trying to figure out what would be the proper way of losing or eating, but still losing weight while I drive a truck.
You know, it's a challenge. Whenever I speak to truck drivers, it's always a challenge to lose weight because here it is, you know, you're hungry. You know, you stop at restaurants and at truck stops on the whole are known for, of course, you know, their mashed potatoes and gravy and hot beef sandwiches.
Helping truckers is getting to be a big important role for Zorba Pastor on your other
We have lots of truckers. We have lots of truckers that listen to us on the road. So one of the ways that you can do this that I think is really important is to control your food. And the way you control your food is by bringing some of that food with you. Not necessarily all of it, but some of it. And that means that taking veggies that you like that are prepackaged, either you make at home if you want to save money, or you buy prepackaged veggies and putting them in that cooler. or the refrigerator in the truck is one of the ways that you can immediately get some control over your food. So one of the things with veggies that are good is we like to have our veggies, and we often like to have them with a dip. So if you're going to have your veggies with a dip, you want to pick a low-fat dip that you like. And that means looking for a salad dressing that you like. And sometimes that means bringing that salad dressing into the truck stop, because theirs has too many calories. Their calories. Salad dressing you buy on the road is cheap because it has high fructose corn syrup, the addictive type of stuff to make it sweet. Even when it says low fat, it often has that sweet, and it has oil in it that you don't need. You know, too much oil that you don't need. So number one, bring those veggies. Number two, bring the salad dressing into the truck stop that you like. And then when you're sitting looking at the menu, be a little creative. I think that sometimes we get stuck into the same meal plans, and being creative makes a difference. I get a magazine I love called Cooks Illustrated. I've been loved the magazine. Real simple. It's also a great magazine because all the recipes are real simple. And what you do is when you're on the road, find other things that you've never tried before and start to make better food, because when you cook your own food, you have control over it and you have control over those calories. And that's how you lose weight. You lose weight by taking some of that money and spending it on your own groceries and making it yourself. Yeah.
Again, our toll-free number, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. Zorba, the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police are after you again.
Oh, gosh, you would think that English were my second language. You know, the grammarians are out there. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I grew up in Chicago. What can I say?
blame the second city. This email comes to us from Jim in St. Louis. If you recall a few weeks ago, Zorba, we were talking about hangovers. Well, Jim writes, I regret having to correct you, but when you were discussing hangovers, you were mispronouncing the word congeners. Coming from your upper Midwestern vocal cords, it sounded like codgeners. As in old codgers.
Like in old folks, that's right.
The N should be pronounced congeners, unless
right.
You're purposely
right. Yes.
Trying to drive us chemists crazy.
Oh, gosh, so it wasn't really grammar, it was pronunciation. It was like
codgies.
Thank you for that. Congeners, I will make sure that I pronounce it correctly. Yes, I do pronounce it sometimes and leave out the N, or I don't know, man, I must slur it.
Well, you've dealt with...
Like but nobody knows what the word means unless you're a chemist.
I didn't have a clue. What
yes.
is it?
Well, congeners are sort of chemical byproducts that are produced. That's really what you could sort of think of it that way. Yeah. They're little chemical byproducts that are produced when you make things.
Well, you've done away with lozengers. So
that's right.
So I'm sure that you'll handle congeners.
Notice they both have N's in there. The N must be the problem. Thank you.
Well, keep your questions and corrections coming. We can take it. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, our producer's available anytime at that toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Adam never sleeps. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, produced by Adam Friedrich, our executive producer, Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be here too next week on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0120Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.